3, which is United States versus Grigsby, and it is Mr. Schobat.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'd like to begin with the obstruction argument. In addition to all the other failings that we've identified, the lack of willfulness, the inability to prove that anything that Ms. Grigsby actually said during her plea colloquy was false, ultimately what upends the government's position and the district court's finding is that there isn't any way that what Ms. Grigsby said during the course of her plea colloquy, which was centered on the issue of was there a factual basis for the charge that she pleaded guilty to, there isn't any way for the government to prove that that statement was material to the ultimate determination on role in the offense.
You know, Mr. Schobat, I don't know what my brother and sister wish you to get into, but boy, I sure appreciate your getting into the factual basis for crediting the co-defendants over this group.
Well, there was none provided by the district court at all. There was no taking of any evidence. There was submissions made by the government relying on grand jury testimony and witness statements. There was a lot of disagreement, even among the cooperating individuals, with respect to how this offense occurred. The one that we highlight in our brief having to do with the distribution of the money is just really a great illustration that nobody in this case who cooperated and provided statements could agree on how the money was distributed. The district court didn't even address that issue at all, didn't say, well, here's why I believe Jennifer Bartel, or here's why I believe Miriam Gurgis, and I think he would have been hard-pressed to decide why or who was telling the truth. Clearly,
argue to him that it would be necessary for him to hear live testimony before determining who was telling the truth, describing Grigsby's role in the offense.
I think when we got to the role in the offense enhancement, Judge, I think what we said to the judge was, even if you accept what these witnesses say as to certain issues, even what they're acknowledging, or if you try to reconcile them, they don't rise to the level of her being a leader. But I think significantly, if you point to, for example, Tommy Gentry's statement that when he first heard about this idea from Jeanette Grigsby, he insisted on seeing the bank supervisor. That is, he insisted on meeting with Bartel. He wasn't going to go forward until he had actually met Bartel. If you accept that statement as being true, that shows that even Tommy Gentry understood that the person who had to be going along with this inside bank theft was Ms. Bartel, because he could have simply met with Ms. Grigsby and said, when are we ready to go, Jeanette? And if she was in charge, she could have told him, here's when we're going to do it, and here's how it's going to be done. There wasn't any need for him to ever meet a Ms. Bartel, but he insisted. It's as if he had said, take me to your leader, and that's what she did. She took him to the leader, which was Jennifer Bartel. Not to mention that even Jennifer Bartel's own testimony was that she was the supervisory manager, that she was the exclusive person in control of the vault, the bank vault. She alone had the password to the bank vault. She was the one who actually escorted the pretend robber to the bank vault, put the money in the bag. She made it possible for there to be $242,000 in that bank. I think the large amount of money involved in this revealed to the FBI almost instantly that this was probably an inside job, because that kind of money isn't often taken by an ordinary person who approaches a teller. And so she was clearly the person, by virtue of her position as the supervisory personnel, and by her arranging the timing of it, that was the leader. Now, had the judge accepted that, apparently he accepted some of the things that Ms. Bartel said, and quite frankly, on one fact, my client agreed that it was, she said it was Ms. Bartel who told her, go find someone who could pretend to be the robber, and she says she met with Tommy Gentry. My client says that that was Ms. Bartel's idea. Ms. Bartel said actually it was my client who said to her, I could find someone if we want to do this. I think Ms. Bartel's version is counterintuitive. The idea that an ordinary teller would approach her boss and say, let's plan an inside bank robbery and I can get somebody to do it, is not only counterintuitive, I think, given what some of the others have said, that they would look to Ms. Bartel for the direction, makes it counterfactual as well. So I don't know how the judge came to the conclusion that what Ms. Grigsby said wasn't true, or that she was the person, for example, who controlled the proceeds. It was clear that the proceeds were controlled by Ms. Bartel in the beginning, and that the persons who then took the money were the staged robbers. They had possession of the money. It was only after they had staged the money and they took their portion. Tommy Gentry took his portion. Dirk Green said, I took my $50,000. They then allegedly handed the money over to my client, who then, among the bank tellers, according to the bank tellers, she was the one who presented the money, and then they distributed it. So his conclusion that somehow my client controlled the proceeds simply isn't supported by any of the statements that the witnesses made. You can go down the other factors, that she was present at critical junctures. She actually wasn't present at all the critical junctures. She wasn't even present during the first state robbery. She wasn't in the vault. She didn't give the money to Tommy Gentry. But if by that the judge meant, well, she was present when they met to discuss the layout of the bank, well, Jennifer Bartel was present as well for that. But she didn't get a supervisory enhancement. If it meant that she was present when the money was being distributed, well, Jennifer Bartel was present for that too. So I don't think that distinguished. There wasn't one individual who the district court judge identified who my client controlled. You know, and under this court's cases, control over other individuals is what matters for a leadership enhancement. He didn't identify a single person. She clearly did not control Tommy Gentry. She didn't even know the other three individuals, Dirk Green, Marcus Gentry, and the third gentleman's name escapes me this minute. She didn't even meet those people. They didn't even know her. In all of their statements, they never even mentioned her. And so she didn't control any of those people, and she clearly didn't control Miriam Gurgis, who was just another ordinary teller, who was actually a person who ordered extra money for the ATM machine. And, of course, she didn't control Jennifer Bartel. Jennifer Bartel was, in fact, her boss. So I think the judge was wrong, obviously, on the leadership role, and he was absolutely wrong on the obstruction enhancement. Unless there are any other questions, I ask that you reverse this case and remand for a new sentencing hearing. Okay.
Mr. Thomas, yes?
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Bill Thomas for the United States.
Are you new?
I'm sorry?
Are you new?
I am new to the office, yes, Your Honor.
You're new to the office?
Yes.
Oh, welcome.
Thank you. I'd like to first address the defendant's claim that concerning the, because you had addressed some, your curiosity about why the judge credited the co-defendants over the defendant.
Now, see, here's my problem. Let me set it out for you. When you have directly contradictory accounts of who was the organizer or leader of an offense, what I'm trying to figure out is how a judge can decide who is telling the truth without hearing each of the witnesses or defendants testify. I'm not getting that.
Your Honor, first, the defense was free to request such a hearing if they wanted it. They never did. I note that co-defendant.
Go on to case B.
Sorry. Okay. In this case, there is no inconsistency that they are trying to characterize. In fact, I think it's critical to note that both Jennifer Bartel and Tommy Gentry, who have no connection to each other at all but for this defendant, independently in their sworn statements verify her role in the offense. They independently do. They don't disagree. The things they disagree about are not critical to her supervisor enhancement. They agree on the fact that, you know, she initiated contact with each of them. She proposed the idea of a staged robbery to each of them.
No, I need to know how a judge can decide who is telling the truth when he hasn't heard all of the witnesses.
Your Honor, I don't think there's any requirement that he hear from live witnesses.
Well, look, if this were a civil case decided on summary judgment, we would surely say there's a conflict of material fact between Ms. Grigsby's statements at the change of plea and, the statements of her co-defendants. I don't understand why this case is different. I mean, essentially, what it seems to me Judge Guzman did here is he granted summary judgment to the government on the question of who was properly characterizing her role in the offense.
Respectfully, I disagree, Your Honor. I think this was a sentencing. The parties had months to decide what they wanted to provide to the judge to make his sentencing decision. Again, if Ms. Grigsby really wanted to attack the credibility of these two independent witnesses who under oath agreed on her role, she was free to do so, and she declined to do so. The key here that the judge, I think, fairly looked at their sworn testimony, noted that these two people who have no contact or connection with each other agreed about all these critical things about what she did and relied on that sworn testimony. There's nothing in this circuit's case.
You didn't hear Barthel and Gentry's statements as to her role in the offense. Those statements were made before the grand jury rather than giving testimony before the judge. It's just hard for me to discern what basis Judge Guzman had for crediting the co-defendants over her.
Your Honor, he did consider those statements because they were part of the pre-sentence report. They were part of the government's version. I believe Ms. Grigsby herself submitted something like 60 pages worth of witness testimony. They're part of the record.
Look, so far as I can tell, what the district court did is this. Simply assumed that because Barthel and Gentry cooperated with the government, both told the same basic story, they were telling the truth as to her role, and she, by contrast, is lying. But who's to say that they weren't downplaying their own culpability for their own gain?
Your Honor, I think the answer to that question is the lower court. This Judge Guzman was the presiding judge for all of these defendants. He oversaw their entire criminal cases from beginning to end.
See, now you're arguing my point, because it seems to me a court has to see all three witnesses testify before it can make a credibility call like this.
Your Honor, I don't think so. I think I merely was pointing out that he's familiar with these defendants. But with respect to this particular case on these facts,
Had he taken plea testimony from the co-defendants at the time of this defendant's sentencing hearing?
I believe all the other defendants were before her. She was either the last or one of the last.
So he had already engaged in a plea colloquy and...
Yeah, that's my understanding, Your Honor. I believe the other defendants all signed plea agreements as well, so there were stipulated facts. This is the only blind plea. So he was the other defendants agreed to a certain stipulated set of facts.
Did he talk about having observed the co-defendants in their own proceedings when he credited their testimony?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe what he said was that there are several witnesses or multiple witnesses who make this defendant clearly a recruiter and a decision maker and an organizer. I think there he's explicitly referring to the other defendants' statements, both in their sworn grand jury statements and also before him in their cases.
So he's making a credibility finding based on the consistency of their grand jury testimony?
He doesn't specify, Your Honor. He says that he's relying on these witnesses who are these co-defendants. It's clear from the record that he is relying, because these statements were submitted by both parties to him for sentencing. And as you pointed out, I think it's correct, he noted that they were entirely consistent. Basically, what you have here is one defendant saying one thing and everyone else saying something else. So the district court is uniquely seated to make that credibility determination. And on these facts, that credibility determination was sufficient under clear error.
We say that when the fact finder actually lays eyes on the witness and makes a credibility determination based on live testimony, when the credibility determination is based on a cold record, the judge really isn't in any better position than we are to make that judgment.
I believe in this case the judge is, because he is familiar with the other defendants. I acknowledge that he did not say that.
Yeah, that's the issue here, is whether he relied on what they said in their plea colloquies to support his credibility call.
Yes, and I believe there's evidence in this record, though, to support his credibility call, and absent a clear error on the judge's part, the defendant needs more to show a clear error than the fact that he relied on sworn testimony from the other co-defendants who are all consistent. And again, I don't mean to repeat myself, but if she really thought that these people should have been cross-examined, that they should have been subject to that kind of scrutiny, she had all the freedom in the world to do that, months of notice as to when the sentencing was. And her co-defendant, Miriam Girgis, in fact, brought in witnesses, had live testimony at her sentencing. So that was something that was more of a tactical choice on her part. I'm not sure, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I don't believe that live witnesses are, I don't think the circuit has ever made that requirement for sentencing. If there are no other questions from the court,
thank you.
We respectfully request that you affirm the sentencing in this matter. Okay.
2 minutes.
Just 2 points. One, the government was the party that was seeking this enhancement, and so they had the burden of proof to present to the judge. So just as the court noted with respect to the summary judgment analogy, if they fail to produce that kind of proof, then giving us the benefit of all reasonable inferences, they simply didn't establish that they were entitled to it. The last thing I would say is, obviously, they did not agree on a lot of critical facts, particularly facts that became part of the district court's ultimate conclusion and its 3 or 4 findings that it made to give that enhancement. So,
thank you, everyone. And the case will be taken under advisement. This court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30.